When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'd just like to warn listeners that this episode does cover the subject of suicide. So if you do need help in the UK, you can contact Samaritans.org. And for the rest of the world, I recommend findahelpline.com. Thank you.
I really haven't spoken about much of this. I mean, it's interesting that I haven't been sought out as a person who knew Dean as well as I did in the last year of his life.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Dean Reed was an American actor, singer, songwriter, director, and socialist who became a huge star in Latin America and the Eastern Bloc. Neil Jacobs is a guitarist who first met Dean Reed briefly while renting accommodation from the director of a documentary of Dean Reed called American Rebel. Neil later served on the US cultural delegation to the Moscow World Youth Festival in 1985, and unlike most of the participants, he was assigned by the Soviets. We talk about how he came to attend and his experiences at this event. And it was at this event that he began his friendship with Dean Reed. Neil then travelled with Dean extensively, both in the US and in the Eastern Bloc from 1985 to 1986, and was one of the last people to see him before his death. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate.
Hello, I'm Nick Packham from Worthing in the UK. I support the Cold War Conversations podcast financially, as it's important that these stories and experiences from the Cold War are preserved before they're lost. Whether you grew up in the Cold War era or you're starting to look into what it was all about, there's something here for everyone.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Neil Jacobs to our Cold War conversation.
I met him because Will Roberts had made the film American Rebel. And my band, which was I was touring with at the time, he had a furniture store that he had bought, big gigantic furniture store, and he lived upstairs with his partner and his children, and I rented the downstairs to rehearse my band. And it was sort of bohemian paradise there. There was the Hare Krishnas lived next door, and they would cater in their saffron robes, and we performed down there. And in the back room was the Moviola, the Steinbeck Moviola, where the Dean Reed movies was being produced. And over time, I became friends with Will Roberts, and we, you know, over chess and Bulgarian wine, we would discuss the film all the time, and the Odyssey of Dean Reed became just a fascinating story for me. And so when my band broke up in 84, he asked me to join the project. So that's how it all started. And there was a point where Dean came marching through to visit in his cowboy boots and, you know, this tall, you know, handsome figure. And I did meet him, but I didn't get to know him till much later. It was over. I knew him more the way you know him, through watching all the outtakes, doing the editing, seeing the films, and learning about the history of his life. My first meeting with him was when he came through in his cowboy boots. And this is, you know, in the 80s, this was not somebody you usually see in a university town that we lived in, Ohio University. And I have to admit, I was a little skeptical of him at the time. And And as I learned more about him, I became more, I felt a lot better about him after that, after a while, because I learned, I had more respect for him. So that's just, that's a story of how this all happened for me.
Phil Everly was in that film as well, wasn't he? Because he was a good friend of Dean's.
That's right. And that's what helped me to know that Phil Everly was in the film, because he was good friends with Dean. And I had the same experience with Dean. We never talked about politics. We just had fun together in our travels. So I concur with Phil on that. He would just, I think he enjoyed the company of Americans, and he felt comfortable with Americans.
I always found that relationship interesting, you know, with Phil being, I think I've read that he was a Reagan fan, and obviously Dean with his left-wing politics, but obviously they left that at the door when they met up as friends. They knew they were going to disagree on it.
See, I had a whole philosophy. Music to me and politics don't go together for me, so I like music for, I perform music, and I'm not really a political figure, and I don't, don't remember actually ever talking about politics with Dean. It was mostly just friendship and kidding around and just enjoying, you know, enjoying life. I think he related to his American friends. I think he realized that his politics weren't going to be in line with a lot of other people's politics anyway.
Yeah.
So we definitely were so 180 degrees different in the way he was a, you know, a superstar, a charismatic entertainer, performer, country, kind of country western-ish pop. And I was more in the jazz realm and just a musician, instrumental and struggling. So we had great differences in that regard. But I feel like he kind of took me under his wing, or he was trying to mentor me, or it was a friendship of sorts. As I tell my story, you'll realize that we spent a lot of time, and I struggled to figure out what he was trying to get through to me. It seemed like he was trying to teach me or tell me something, but I, for the life of me, I don't know.
Now, American Rebel was filmed in quite a lot of different countries. Did you actually go with the crew, or were you just involved in the editing side of it?
Just editing and talking, discussing it. I mean, when they did the final in Moscow in 85, they did some of the shooting there that with Renata and some of the interviews with Dean. That was shot in 85. And I was around when Phil Everly was shot, but I wasn't there. They sent a crew there. I didn't go to any of the countries except for Moscow. In 85, Will had secured two invitations to the Moscow Film Festival, and I decided to go. He invited me. I went, and I thought, what the heck? It's 2 weeks. It's, even though it was the evil empire at that point, and Reagan said, don't go. I was just sort of curious, and I went. So it was an interesting place to be. It was Gorbachev was just in, Perestroika, and it was sort of the changing of the guard there. It was a historical time to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And was this the first screening of American Rebel at this film festival, or was it just one of the films that was on at the festival?
Surprisingly, it wasn't screened at that festival. It was just an invitation. I think we wanted to shoot some footage of Dean, some final footage, and the film wasn't finished yet. So Will had been there previously, I think in 79, if I'm correct, for one of his earlier films. So I think that was the hook there. And so it was mostly just to gather some footage and just be a part of the film festival, which was a remarkable place to go on your first trip abroad, I have to say.
So at the film festival, what did you get up to there?
All kinds of mischief. I mean, it was kind of place where you got up in the morning and you had breakfast with the members of the Hollywood 10, or you might go to the Red Square and sign autographs, or just all over the place. It was a remarkable time.
So the Hollywood 10 were the directors and writers who had been...
They were blacklisted. That many of these figures I would never meet in normal life, that's for sure. And, well, Dean was, we stayed at the Hotel Rossiya, as you probably have become aware of, that the gigantic hotel right next to Red Square. And I would go play in the press bar, and I met the son-in-law of the head composer of the Soviet Union, Tikhon Krenikov, and he invited me to meet his father and play for him. And so I did, and I played. Of course, I'm an American. I don't know much about classical music. I was a jazz musician, but I played the only thing I knew. I learned in kindergarten was Peter and the Wolf. And it led to me being invited to stay in Moscow. That was an interesting introduction. So I ended up staying there for over a month. We had got invited to the Kremlin for dinner at the end of the film festival. They lost my luggage. I made the rookie mistake of bringing really fancy luggage. Somebody gave me a gift of some beautiful Hartmann luggage, and it got to Moscow and it never got there. So all my clothes I brought on the plane were all I had for the whole trip. We had invited to the Kremlin for dinner with people like Norman Jewison and Dean Reed. We all went, and they wouldn't let me go because I didn't have proper clothing. And Dean had to argue for me and get me on the bus and get me into the Kremlin for the party. Dean also would argue for me in front of the committees to have me stay in Moscow. I don't know what he was arguing about, but he was trying to tell them that they needed musicians like me there. And throughout my travels with Dean, he was always seemed to be getting my back in strange situations, taking care of me. The long and short of it, we went to the Kremlin, had dinner, and a big party, and I remember the orchestra playing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head on the way in. I'll never forget that. It was very kitschy. Oh, I'm rambling now. I'm sorry.
I mean, it's these little details which make the stories, to be honest, Neil. I mean, you know, that I'm still dealing with that image of the orchestra playing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
You're walking down into this lower level. Above you is this huge orchestra, and they're playing Raindrops Keep Falling, and you're going to this grand hall with, you know, white tables, you know, it seems like 100 feet long with the caviar and all the, you know, the chandeliers and everything. And you're listening to Raindrops Keep Falling on Your Head. And you're thinking, here I am. It's sort of a psychosis you get from you're there with Dean Reed, first of all. And it's really hard to put into words what that's like. And you're just a kid from Ohio and you're suddenly thrust into these situations.
It seems like Dean sort of, you were a fellow musician, and by the sound of it, took you under his wing.
I got talked into staying into Moscow for the World Youth Festival, and that was, I think, had to be partially his doing. Surprisingly, I have to say, I played Prokofiev for Tikhon Krenikov. I played Peter and the Wolf, and he thought that was humorous. And later I learned that Prokofiev was actually, they were not good friends at all, and Tikhon was credited with allowing Prokofiev's first wife to be sent to the gulag. So I think that's an interesting that I would pick that song of all songs to play for him.
Yeah, of all composers that you had to choose, you chose the one where the guy had sent the composer's wife to the gulag. That is, I'm surprised you made it out, to be honest, but
I have to correct you there. He allowed it, suppose. It's a difference between the formalist musicians, what they call formalists, and like socialist realist musicians. They didn't want the creative musicians necessarily. They want the ones to glorify the great socialist and movement, I guess. You know, Tikhon was appointed by Stalin in the 30s, and he stayed the head composer until 1991 when they disbanded the whole thing. So he was a very powerful person.
Yeah, when I was researching this, I was amazed that Stalin had appointed him and that he was still there through to the end of the Soviet Union. But had the right friends.
So I stayed on. So I stayed on in Moscow. And the good story is that Dean, I've been to the airport a couple of times trying to get my luggage, and I think Dean was fed up after a while, and he said, "That's it. I'm going to the airport with you." So he drove me down to the airport and asked the luggage tender there where my luggage was, and they said, "We don't know." They shrugged their shoulders. And Dean just hopped over the gate, walked to the back room, turned the corner, picked it up, brought it out, and slammed it down in front of me. That kind of gives you an idea who Dean was and how much he kind of understood what was going on all the time. So I did get my clothes to stay in Moscow for another month.
Yeah, so you feel he had no illusion as to what the Soviet Union was like in terms of corruption?
Yes. Yes, and I will get to, yeah, that's the point I'd like to touch on later. But yeah, I think he knew. I think he was aware and just how things worked.
Yeah. So what was the World Youth Festival like?
You have to remember, I stayed for about 4 weeks alone, I think, in the Metropole Hotel leading up to it. So I just kind of wandered around the city and going down the deep, I think if you know the deep escalators into the chandeliered subway systems and all that. I had did nothing for 2 weeks. So I just wandered the city. By the time the World Youth Festival arrived, they were, the delegates were from like 150 countries, I think, just a massive festival. But the American delegation is like a, you had to go through a huge screening process and tests, and it was a handpick, and some political powerful people got in there. And when they arrived, they found me there, appointed by the Russians. So they were all suspicious of me, I believe. It made it rather uncomfortable. Taking the bus to Lenin Stadium and for the opening ceremony when, you know, Gorbachev was there and they were singing the protest songs in the bus, I remember, and I didn't know any of the words, so that added to the suspicion.
So, I mean, surely these musicians were pretty left-wing anyway to have been selected to sing at this festival.
They weren't necessarily, they didn't have many in the way of performers. Their performance, there were all kinds of delegates, and the cultural delegation was a tiny part of it, I believe. But they didn't have many musicians there. They're kind of happy. They found that it was nice to have some musician, in a real musician, because they needed them, because we had to put on a big show. And the Russians were expecting something great out of the American delegation. Everybody was, because of Michael Jackson, and they expected something like that. Well, they got sort of our apparatchiks, and it was a disappointment, our performance. It was a great time to be there, though, because I remember Ramona talking about how Dean would go into Red Square and sign autographs all night long, or you just sign autographs and get pinned with all. I had the same experience. I would go to Red Square and be sign autographs forever, and I'd have interpreters would come out of the crowd and interpret what I was saying. Everybody would ask me questions, and I was like a ambassador of sorts.
And who did they think you were then?
Just an American. I think they were just maybe they thought I was somebody. I thought, well, maybe they saw my performance, but I don't think so. I think the fact that you were an American in that time period, you're very special. And they were fascinated, and they wanted to know all the questions. And I would just sign autographs forever in Red Square. And it got to be a thing where I did it a couple of times just for fun and just to talk to people. But then again, you don't know what the interpreters, what they're saying, what they're interpreting. Where did this interpreter come from suddenly, who's telling them what I'm saying? It was curious. And plus, they would give me, I was guest of state. I'd go to the Bolshoi. I'd go play. I got an invitation to play with the chess masters in an exhibition. I played at Moscow University. It was a marvelous time to be there. And I was with Dean. And my only source of reality was Dean. Of course, I was there for Dean's performance at Gorky Park. We were riding around in the car when Ramona talks about being there with Dean. I was in the car with him. I was traveling around the town that day, and he was taking me to record at Melodia Studios, but he decided that Udo Lindenberg was performing before him that day at Gorky Park, the big World Youth Festival finale, I think, concert. He didn't feel comfortable because Udo Lindenberg had a full band and he didn't have a band, and we diverted across Moscow and he got some tracks to play with, which, of course, I advised him not to, because I'd never heard of anybody playing with tracks before. I didn't think it was okay, but not that he would listen to me. He didn't, of course.
How do you mean play with tracks?
It means he had a band on tape or.
Oh, I see.
They played through the play through, you know, he played too. And I
yeah.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Now it's very common, but back then I'd never heard of that before. The concert with him, the women rocking the car, the flowers, the whole thing. With Dean Reed, it was pretty normal to go through all that. It was
unbelievably so. I guess the other thing with Udo Lindenberg is I think he had a song that was critical of Eric Honecker. Mm. That he
yes,
used
I think
to sing.
You're right. I remember that.
And
yes.
Dean might not have been comfortable because that was effectively his home country, wasn't it? East Germany at this point.
Yes.
Be comfortable being that or associated with Udo Lindenberg. I don't know. That could have been the other reason, possibly. At this point, sort of Dean is your best buddy then, really?
I would hesitate to say that. I don't feel like I ever really knew Dean that well. I hate to say that. I mean, I don't know who did really know him that well, you know, of him. He's there. He's powerful. He's invincible. And I think when I look back on it, I think there was a friendship that I didn't realize at the time. I was bewildered most of the time at everything that was going on. So I think I wasn't paying attention to that, but I was always happy to see him because he was the most normal person I could find at the time.
And did he ever talk to you about things other than music and stuff like that? Did he talk to you about how he felt about anything, or was that not really part of the relationship you had with him?
Later, when we were traveling in America right. together, we drove across from New York into Ohio together, and he got interested in the United States, and he wanted to come back and get an RV and bring Renata and drive across the country in America. He was starting to get, you could feel that homesick part of him where he really was looking to coming back. And I think he enjoyed traveling. He enjoyed seeing the United States. And I think it happened when we were in New York. We were finishing a film, and the film was delayed. We were getting it ready to go to be premiered at the Denver Film Festival. That's where it premiered. And the film was delayed. And so Dean and I decided to go drive to my home in Ohio and then fly to the Denver Film Festival from there. And we talked a lot along the way then. And Will stayed back in New York and tried to fuss with finishing the film. So.
And what did you talk about on that journey to Ohio?
A lot of things about how much he really enjoyed Americans. I mean, I had a girlfriend at the time. She greeted me. She jumped in my arms, happy to see me. And he just said, oh, that's, you know, I wish I missed that so much, because Germans were, to him, were kind of cold. And I hate to say that. He didn't feel at home, and with the humor, with just the dispassionate part of their life. And plus we go shopping, you know, in the 80s, I think he got to see middle America as in the 80s in the United States was starting to become more affluent. And we were going to the governor's mansion for the party at the film festival in Denver. And I had to get some clothes. So I went to one of the biggest malls at the time when shopping malls were big in the 80s. And he was like impressed with the size and scope of these monster shopping malls in the Midwest. And we went in. I had to buy some shoes. I bought some shoes, and I got outside the wall. I said, no, I don't want them. I'm going to take them back. And Dean said, you can't take those back. And I said, yeah, of course I can. And he said, of course. And he said, no, you can't take those back. I'll bet you $20 you can't take those back. You know, of course. Just plop them down. They took them right back. And that was how much he was a little, didn't understand maybe the West as much that he left.
It's almost as though he's in exile, isn't he, in East Germany, and wants to come back and establish a career or just live as an ordinary American and not really have the publicity.
I can't speak to that. I think he was going to try and come back and run for office or whatever he thought, build some kind of career. It would have been really hard for him, I think. But from Ohio, we flew to Denver, and that's when everything got kind of crazy, when we arrived at the airport and, you know, all the press and the insanity, and got in trouble on the radio show. And then the opening of the film, there were the bomb threats and the death threats. And, of course, Will and I went in. The police ushered us in through the basement entrance. And all I kept saying was, where's Dean? Where's Dean? And, of course, Dean didn't go in through the basement in front of the secret with the police. He went right up the front.
So what did he say on the radio show then that got him into trouble?
I wasn't at the radio show, but it was, they were a little tense about the assassination of the radio personality. The name escapes me right now. And when Dean went on there, they had a little row, accusing him of being a fascist, I think, or Dean accusing him of being something. There was something. It was on the radio. It was much blown out of proportion. I think someone else who was there would be better to explain that. But
right, but the press would have loved that. And
oh, they loved it. It was perfect. Yeah. I mean, you know, I tried to explain that Colorado was a very conservative place in the 80s. They weren't accepting of their, they didn't accept him as a hometown hero. Let's put it that way.
But ordinarily, he wouldn't have been recognized in the U.S., would he?
No, I just can't imagine that he would have. It's just the press was there and got the publicity. It got a lot of excitement about, you know, we were, American Rebel was, we were doing the debuting it there.
And how was the film received?
I don't think there was a great reception on the film. I don't remember. I remember the after party was a little, nothing special. I don't think it was... I don't think the reviews were great. I don't recall much. We were too busy going off and running off to the Estes Park. He wanted to go back to his boyhood start, where he started his career up in the Rocky Mountains at the sort of the Dude Ranch and playing. And he commandeered a limousine, and we all rode up there and kind of watching the news coverage of the film festival as we rode up and played guitars and sang. And it was a fun moment, a fun time with Dean. Got great pictures of this. A few times I had a camera.
Yeah. It's a sad story, because I'm, you know, what I'm hearing here is sort of, you know, a man who does want to come back to the US, but just doesn't sort of fit in.
I think in his mind he could have overcome that. I'm not sure that he was disappointed, but of course he was going right on to 60 Minutes. That's when he did the fateful 60 Minutes interview during that trip. And he went to Hollywood, and then he came back to my home in Ohio, and Will and I showed the film at Ohio University, so he came to that too. So we spent more time, and during that time, he asked me to come play in on his cowboy show in Germany in May. So,
did you watch the 60 Minutes interview when it was broadcast, Neil?
Yes, I did. I watched it. I thought it was a bit unfair. I mean, they really didn't make him look very good. They didn't do him any favors, and they picked the most controversial subjects to. I'm sure they interviewed him for hours and cherry-picked some stuff. But I think he did his best. I think he was in a bad position. He's got his wife is a star and, you know, entertainment star. And in East Germany, I think he was dancing around some things. But I think he's also sincere. I remember one of the only times I did talk about politics with him at that point was I wasn't feeling very comfortable with him giving the – the company line on the Berlin Wall. I really thought that was death. And of course, they jumped on that when he said it was to keep people out. That was, I think it was a bad moment in that interview.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, there's even more criticism of him after that. How soon after that did you next see him?
Well, when he did the interview, I don't know when it aired. It must have aired a month or two later. And I just saw it again recently, and I had a different take on it. It wasn't as bad as I thought, but I wish they'd have shown a lot of footage of his earlier days at his heyday. It's like, you mean, it would have been nice to get a better perspective on him, but I didn't feel like that was their intention. So, but I, next time I saw him, next time would be May Day, 1986. I flew in to Berlin, and well, the odd part is that Chernobyl had just caught fire in late April, and I flew in on April 30th, and I was flying. I got on the plane, and so I'm going to play a cowboy show. I don't know anything about cowboy music. And the last minute, Dean had written me and said, I can't do the one song I need. The only song I knew, which was Ghost Riders and William Tell Overture, was going to be my big song. And he, no, there's a singer who's going to sing that song. So you got to think of something else. You know, but I was nervous. I guess that's the point I'm making. And Chernobyl was burning, and they were thinking more reactors were going to catch fire, and it was going to be a disaster. And I got to Kennedy Airport, and when I got to Kennedy, I called back to Will, and I said, did the second reactor catch on fire? Because I'm getting off the plane if it did. And they said it hadn't. So I went ahead and flew to Berlin. And it's a great story because Dean was at my house in Ohio, and there's an old barn. I had an old saddle. He was doing the film on Bloody Heart about the Wounded Knee story, his big film he wanted to finish up. And I had an old saddle in the barn. He said, could you bring that? And I thought, I'll pay you for it when you get here. Because they didn't have any Western saddles at all. And there's nothing that looks like that. He wanted something authentic. So I arrived in Berlin with a guitar on one shoulder and a saddle on the other to go play a cowboy show. So it was really surreal. And Chernobyl was on fire. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And I got off the plane. And Dean knew I looked really humorous at that point in Berlin. And I asked him, what's going on with Chernobyl? Are we okay? He said, oh, we've got it completely under control. There's no problem. It's all Western propaganda. So I said, I wasn't comforted, but okay, this is what it's going to be. I'm not going to know anything from here on out. So that's how I arrived. And that's the next time I saw him. We drove through Checkpoint Charlie and the whole thing into East Berlin because you have to fly to West Berlin. And it was Communist Workers' Holiday, May 1st. And all the parades, we went around to some of the parades, saw that, took him to my hotel. And next night we went out to dinner and with Renata, it was her birthday. We went to the symphony. We had a fun time. And he said, I got to go back to Ukraine now to finish up on the film, Crimea, which was Ukraine at the time. I'll meet you there. You got to get a visa to go to Czechoslovakia because we're going to go on vacation after the show, and you know we got to get there, and you got to arrange travel to Leipzig and sign me your interpreter. And so the next time I got that taken care of and got to Leipzig for the show. I'm really nervous enough as it was. I didn't know anything about Chernobyl. I didn't know anything about cowboy music, and I basically playing a show that was like hee-haw and everyone was dressed in cowboy outfits. I don't know if you've seen footage from it.
I have seen footage. So when you say hee-haw, you mean it's sort of like really fake and really kitschy?
Well, a kitschy variety show. I guess the Germans were really into American Western cowboy motif at that point, or the whole, whereas the Russians weren't. I kind of got that.
Yeah, well, they were. They had a fiction writer called Karl May in Germany who wrote a lot of books about Native Americans and cowboys. And I think that's where the sort of appetite for the Westerns came from, was from those books.
Well, plus Dean would do all the Sing Cowboy Sing and Blood Brothers and those kind of movies too. Anyway, I guess the next time I saw Dean, he had arranged so I took for me to have his suite, and he was staying somewhere else. I think either it was like a huge favor to me, or he didn't want to stay in the room they assigned him. I couldn't tell. I'll never know to this day, because I knew that Dean always played with, whenever we were in a hotel, anywhere or travel, he would always play with the recording devices and yell, you know, about smoking dope, or, you know, he was always tweaking them. He was always doing the absolute, whatever he could to annoy the people listening in on the hotels. So, but that speaks to the next part of the story. The first time I saw him when I was in Leipzig, he barged in to my room, and he was livid and completely beside himself. He was so angry. I've never seen Dean angry. So he was really angry, and he was screaming, and he just said, I don't talk about this much, but he was saying they were executing soldiers in Chernobyl. They were lining them up, and if they didn't go on the suicide mission to fight the fire, they were going to kill them. I don't remember. It seems to me he thought they were shooting them. I have no idea, but he was really angry. And this is the kind of information I didn't want to know, but that was right before the show. And that's the last he ever talked about it. I didn't.
What did you make of East Germany?
East Germany, one thing I like to say is when I was in West Germany, it was like it was in color. And when I got to East Germany, I had to spend a few days alone in Berlin. It was like black and white, and everybody seemed paranoid and kind of scared. I mean, you could just feel it. I made the mistake of, I thought, oh, wow, I got into one of the train stations, and I started taking pictures, like a panoramic picture around the train station. And I remember when I had it developed, when I got home, there were all these East German men just scowling at me because it was illegal. You weren't allowed to do that. I didn't know.
Yeah.
They say, what, 30% of the people were informants or more? It just had a paranoid, sort of uncomfortable, anxious feeling everywhere. And it just wasn't very, not friendly, no.
Did Dean talk much about, or did he talk to you at all about how he felt about East Germany, or this was, that would have been too close to politics and he would have just steered clear of that?
No, like I said, he wasn't comfortable. I don't think he felt comfortable with the humor, and he didn't like saying I love you. He hated the way the words I love you were in German, and the humor, and he didn't have many friends. He loved the Czechs. He said he really enjoyed the Czechs, the company of the Czechs. Of course, the band, I think the band in the backup band in the Cowboy Show was from Czechoslovakia.
Did you sense that he was concerned about his music becoming outdated? Because he was sort of, his style was from an era that was disappearing quite quickly in the 1980s, wasn't it?
Yes, that would be my understanding. I mean, the Eastern Bloc was now getting a lot more music from the West, and I would think he would be going that style. He was more of a classic, iconic person. As you get older, I think that's normal in music anyway. You can't keep that up. But yeah, I'm sure he felt that he was going out of style. Maybe. I can't imagine him not noticing.
So you then travel for a holiday in Prague. How was that? What did you get up to there?
Well, you know, he loved to show you. We went to Dresden. He showed me all the warmer. He wanted to show me as much as he could. I just felt like they took me to see Karl Gott, the very famous singer, to his home. And supposed to be the greatest singer in Czechoslovakia. And then he took me to his friends' homes. And we got to Prague. It was like a vacation. I mean, Renata said he never goes on vacations with his male friends. Yeah, she thought that was really strange. So I thought, I felt a little bit honored. We got to Prague. He parked his car on the sidewalk sideways. Didn't even bother to find a parking spot. And we went in for a vacation in Prague, just walking around through the streets. And Prague in 85 was not the cattle call that it is now. It was a beautiful city. It was, there weren't a lot of people. It was a nice adventure. We went on to the St. Charles Bridge, I remember, and he wanted to just busk for, he wanted to see if people would give him money for playing on the bridge, you know, just acoustically and just as a nobody there. We went back to the hotel and went back to the car, and there were police all around it. And they're getting ready to tow it and write tickets. They were really angry. And they see Dean coming, and they go, "Oh, it's Dean. Oh, it's just Dean." And they waved their hand, they laughed, and they walked away.
Unbelievable. How did it? Did he manage to get any coins on Charles Bridge with his busking?
We didn't do it. He was musing. And later on that night, though, he said, "Let's get drunk and tear down Russian flags in Prague. Just go out and tear down flags all over the city." I look back and I said, he was kind of angry at the Russians. Why would he say something like that? And of course, he knows he's being recorded. And I'm thinking, no, Dean, I don't think I want to go rip down Russian flags in the city.
Yeah, he's, I was going to say state of mind, but it's probably not state of mind, but he's still angry about what he's hearing about Chernobyl.
Perhaps. But, you know, he's always kind of rebellious and, you know.
Yeah. And how far away was this from his death?
Well, I'll get to that. Not very far. That's the thing. We drove back after our vacation. We drove. And he would, on the road, he'd point out, "Oh, there's a secret East German military base over there and the air base there." And I said, "Dean, don't tell me these things. Just be asleep." He's having a great old time with me. And we got back to his home, which is right on the lake. And he has a small motorboat. And we went out to what they call the Venice of Berlin, he called it, and rode around. And we have great pictures of us just funning around. If boat broke down in the middle of the lake and he's fixing it. We're just having a great old time on the boat. And get back. And I flew back to the United States, and it was just a matter of weeks. He was found in that lake. Yeah, I just sort of, it's really hard to talk about that. So I don't really usually, it was so strange to have him, have it be like that so quickly. All the theories to me, I have different feelings about some of the theories on what happened, but that's just hard to talk about, really.
Presumably you had no indication that this was what was going to happen. You know, he was obviously angry and rebelling against his life in Eastern Europe. But I think Ramona talks about, you know, him, he was going to arrange a surprise party or something for her in the US. And he'd been planning that with her. And then his body's found in the lake near his home. And in the Stasi files, they have what they say is a suicide note that I think was written on the back of a script or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't quite make sense to me. He was finishing a film. He was, I got no sense of any depression. He was looking forward. Got nothing. He's not the kind of person that would commit suicide. It would be a, he'd make a big deal out of it if he was going to do that. This just doesn't add up to me. His mother flew me out to Hawaii. You know, I was, when he passed, I was a little bit nervous. I was anxious about really talking about much about it. You know, the Chernobyl thing, it only became common knowledge later. And I'm not saying that was what did it. It may have been a death by a thousand cuts, but he was always rebellious to a point and had fun doing that. So you got to couch it in those terms. That was his nature, to be rebellious. And plus, he thought he was invincible. At least I think he did. But when his mother flew me to Hawaii, she wanted to know, she went to the service, and I didn't. But I was a bit nervous.
and the money was a little tight back then. So I think Will went, and Ruthanna Brown went, his mother. And when she flew me out to Hawaii, she wanted me to tell them what happened, you know, everything that happened in the final days. And she took me to a psychic and all this. But she had this, had his appointment book. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but had he lived a few more days, he had this, she showed it to me in big capital letters, call BBC, call NBC, call ABC, all the news networks. And it was big caps. He was going to make an announcement. So doesn't sound like a person was going to commit suicide. There was something he was going to announce, obviously. And maybe that was coming, maybe it was going to surprise Ramona, but that wasn't the main.
So do you feel that, you know, the hand of the East German government or something might have been behind it because they were worried about what he was going to announce or knew what he was going to announce and didn't want it announced?
One would speculate that. I think East Germany was hanging on. They were one of the last places to really fall. They were going to fall soon. It was, I think they were trying. It would have been a great embarrassment for Dean to leave, I would think. You don't leave. You don't give them a black eye. Leaving would give them a black eye. There were other things. He was, well, I think he might have talked too much, too. He was, he knew a lot. He had connections to know a lot about what was going on. You would hate to have somebody like Dean turn against you. I don't think he would. I think he believed in socialism. I think he was sincere in his belief system and on all that. I don't think he would have. But I think he had his doubts.
Yeah, I think he, from what I can just try and piece together here, I think he towards the end, he had doubts about how the application of socialism was in certainly East Germany and possibly the Soviet and probably the Soviet Union as well. I think you're right. He was probably quite honest in his beliefs, but you know, the reality of how it was applied in those countries was something he wasn't comfortable with. I mean, he may well have been announcing that he was going to return to the US. And as you say, that would have been quite an embarrassment to the East German government, but whether that's enough for them to take his life, I don't know.
Well, I think Ruthanna Brown had been studying. There was a lot of celebrities that seemed to die mysteriously in the East. So I don't know enough about that to speak to that, but it seems that there were a lot of deaths during that time period of people just dying mysteriously.
During these last week, I mean, how much did he talk to you about, you know, future plans or what did he talk to you about, you know, when you were on that boat trip with him?
It's just lighthearted stuff. Just enjoying life. I mean,
And was that generally the level of conversation that you had with him, was generally lighthearted? Was there any sort of like deeper conversations where he was almost not confessing, but obviously a deeper conversation about how he felt and what his challenges and problems were? Or was it always at quite a light level with
him? I think it was a light level for the most part. I think he was happy to have an American around. At the time I almost felt like I thought he was felt safer because I was there. Oddly, he might've been afraid, but it's hard to really picture that with him, given some of the other things. I think he just missed having American friends, I think. I can only guess.
I mean, I've seen that 60 Minutes documentary, and the house seems to be full of American sort of artifacts and things on the wall and stuff like that. He's, you know, it's almost as though he's trying to recreate America in his home. I don't know whether you remember that from the footage.
Well, I was there. I remember seeing the home. Yes, he's got a lot of Native American things. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he would have been getting tired of East Germany. He probably did want to come back to America. I don't know what he was going to do. I don't think Renata would have come. Don't think she could have left. I know she would have been comfortable in America. So I don't think he was. That might have been a source of some troubles. But I have to believe he wanted to come home. He wanted to come back to America. And that would be my guess on the announcement. I don't want to play up the Chernobyl thing too much because I don't know how important that was. But you have to remember, Chernobyl was not the real story of Chernobyl didn't come out till many years later.
Yeah. But I think it's important, you know, you describing that it was the angriest you'd ever seen him. You know, he was livid about this information.
It was shocking. Shocking. So I think it might have added to his disillusionment. I think they knew that he knew about it and no one else knew about it. So him coming back would be a problem on for that too with the Russians. Just a guess.
Right. So the rest of East Germany didn't know about Chernobyl apart from, I guess, if they're listening to Radio Free Europe or something like that, which they will be, or watching West German TV, they would definitely know.
But even in America,
what was going on?
Even in America, they really didn't know the story. I mean,
yeah,
what was going on there, the depth of it, till much later. He had to know that he was always being recorded. So I think he may have gone over the line. That's kind of my guess. And if he was thinking about leaving socialism, that might have been too much. But it's hard to know. It's all hard to know. I mean, it's almost logical. I just wish I could be more helpful. I wish that I had. He told me lots of wonderful things that I could relay. We were just fellow travelers, and I just wish I could be more helpful. I'd like to put this thing. It's such an amazing odyssey, such an amazing story that it's just nice to touch. It's nice to actually get it off my chest because I have to say I was pretty anxious for a few years after his death, and I didn't feel very comfortable. And it's actually thank you for letting me talk about it a little bit. I hope I was somewhat articulate.
Absolutely, absolutely. What the anxiousness was that sort of fear of something coming your way from his death or what was that anxiousness that you had?
The last, if he was assassinated, I was kind of the last person to be around him and know if there were secrets, maybe.
All right. So there was a fear that somebody might think that Dean had told you a load of things that he shouldn't have done and that you might then pass them on.
I suppose not directly. You can only imagine being with somebody like Dean, being traveling with him, and you're there right where he's murdered, if he's murdered. And a few weeks later, you come back home, and then he's murdered right where you were. And some of the details on the autopsy are, from what I've heard, are kind of frightening too. So, or his state of his body, then he might have been tortured, and he might have had his tongue cut out, things like that. Frightening. I don't know how much I can believe of that, but I've heard things that were kind of scary.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can imagine you being concerned about your welfare. You know, from what you've said, it's sort of, you know, there's a load of uncertainty about what actually happened, but the indication does appear to be from, you know, what you saw of Dean in those last weeks is you had no reason to think that he was going to take his life.
None whatsoever. None. Not even depression. No sense of that. You think there would be some indication.
You know, the indications I get is that he was feeling homesick and he was ready to try and go back to America.
Yes. I mean, yes. I would think that would be the first thing. I think he wanted to finish the film and get that. I don't know if that was actually going to be, he was going to be successful in finishing the Bloody Heart film. But my feeling is he wanted to come home. More than anything else, I mean, Chernobyl, that was a big deal. I don't think you should undersell that. Just because it was the information of it kind of dribbled out over decades, kind of watered it down. But the impact of that, had that could have been a world-changing event. It just so happened the wind blew on a very fortunate direction. So it could have been a horrific event. And it was quite an indictment on the Soviet Union too. It would have been a massive problem for them. So I don't think anyone can undersell that. That was a big deal, and Dean was really angry about it. So I'm not saying that's what did it, but it could have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.